You're listening to Further Faster in association with Montane, the podcast that asks ultra athletes, mountaineers, and explorers the why and the how.
Hello and welcome to Further Faster in association with Montane. My name is Daniel Nielsen, and in this series of podcasts, I speak to ultra athletes, climbers, explorers, and mountaineers to find out how they do what they do and why they do what they do. In this month's podcast, I speak to someone who perhaps has delved deeper than most into these questions. If you're a climber, you're going to know Jerry Moffitt. He's one of the best of all time. We speak primarily, however, about theories of mastermind. It's a manual of sorts for better climbing, not the physical, not the route choice, but the psychological. It's at once alarming and affirming, insightful and exciting. Now, I'm not a climber, but I left this conversation learning so much about what we can do to achieve our goals. This, after all, is a conversation about life, not just climbing. Listen in. Okay, Jerry Moffitt, welcome to Further Faster. Thank you for your time this morning.
Yeah, no problem.
So one of the things that we do on the podcast is really to kind of get in depth about the psychology behind climbing, behind exploring, behind ultra athletes and that kind of thing. And as a very successful climber yourself, you've also just written a book that kind of really aligns with this, called Mastermind. So tell us, really, we're going to flick back through your career a bit later, but tell us first of all a little bit about the book and why you thought now was the right time to write it.
Well, I was always interested in sport psychology. Mm-hmm. When I was climbing, how to think, how to prepare yourself. When I was doing competitions, it was very different from when I was doing dangerous routes. So I did a lot of free soloing without ropes. I didn't really have a problem with that.
Right.
And then I went to competitions. It was something outside my comfort zone. And I found myself getting more scared and nervous in competitions than I was when I was in a death situation.
Yeah.
You know, with all the audience there, your friends watching, the fear of failure, the fear of traveling all the way down there and not competing well, not winning the prize money, feeling you're the best there, but not being the best on the day, all those different things. Mm-hmm. just threw my mind into spaghetti and I underperformed.
Right.
So I started researching sports psychology way back in the late 80s, and that's where I got my interest. So a couple of years ago, I thought I was speaking to a guy who'd done some books, and I was talking and just saying I'd really like to do a book on sports psychology, and he was like, let's do it together.
Right, okay.
So that was the start of it, and then I thought, I know all the best climbers in the world. That they'd heard of me because I was a famous climber in my time. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wouldn't it be really good to get all the best climbers in the world from all the different genres, from bouldering, soloing, competitions, mm-hmm. interview them and say what they're thinking before they do a climb. And then to move that further on, I thought, let's speak to some real extreme people. So we've got Alex Honnold from Free Solo. Mm-hmm. And then I spoke to people like Mitch Kemeter, who's got some world records slacklining,
right, okay.
Which is, you know, just one of the most scary things. I spoke to Leo Holding about base jumping. What do they think before they're about to just throw themselves off and do some wingsuit fly? So I wanted to cover the whole spectrum of climbing and extreme sports.
Okay. And of all the, so let's go through the format of the book, because it's split into several sections. What tell us about how you decided how to split it.
So basically I researched, and I kind of knew from research and reading a lot of books, what you should be thinking, how you should be thinking, how you should prepare yourself, how your conscious mind works and how your conscious mind's influences unconsciously what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So I knew a lot of the stuff, I'd researched it, but my whole point was to use the climbers to reinforce what I'm saying. So I wasn't going in there going, oh, I wonder what you should be thinking. I knew what you should be thinking. And then I'd interview different climbers and they would say exactly what I was saying. So it was to put that point over. So I did a load of research and split the book into different sections, like the conscious mind, the unconscious mind, different things like that, wrote the whole thing. And then a friend of a friend is one of the top sports psychologists in the country, a guy called Lou Harding, who happens to be a climber, who happened to read my first book, Revelations, which is my autobiography. The guy's now retired, but he's just, he's way out there. He's super, super intelligent, and he knows everything about all this stuff. Yeah. So my friend put me in touch with him. I went to see him, showed him all the stuff and said, is this correct? So he sat down with me and very kindly gave me a load of his time. And that really changed the influence of the book because, you know, it's a scientific book as well. You know, it's a book of fact. It's not just a load of ideas out there like, hey, try this, see if it works. It definitely works. Things like visualization, things like that. So he looked through it all and then went over and he was very good. He was like, well, we wouldn't quite say it like that. We might say it a little bit more like that. And I was like, oh, I got that wrong.
Yeah.
So I know that he went through the book and he's been a professor at Bangor University his whole life. So it's his life work.
Okay. And when you started researching the sports psychology, you know, back in the 80s, when you realized that there was something wrong when you went to these competitions, presumably there weren't books about climbing, it was more to do with professional athletes in different spheres.
Would that be right? Well, what happened to me was I was in Germany. I did a competition there, and I was climbing the best I'd ever climbed. I lost weight. I was powerful. I was strong. I was consistently on site in the hardest routes in the world. And I went there and completely choked.
Right.
I was in a desperate situation. I told my parents and they said, oh, we just read an article about an archer in the local newspaper. And she read a book called With Winning in Mind,
right,
an American book, and it changed her life and changed her competing. So they phoned up the newspaper, contacted the woman and said, what's this book?
Yeah.
She said what the book was. You couldn't buy the book in England. I sent off to America for the book and I got a load of cassettes.
Right, okay.
So I sent off for the cassettes. They came from America. At the time, they cost, I think they were $200.
Blimey.
Which back then for me was a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
So I bought these tapes, bought the book, and I just threw myself into the book. And the next competition coming up was the very first ever UIAA World Cup event in England.
Yeah.
So it was the first World Cup event, and it was in England, and it was the first competition in England.
Yeah.
And I just choked on the last one. So I read this book, threw myself into it, did all the exercises. I wrote everything down. I listened to the tape. I went to the competition, and I won the competition in the super final. Right. Then I won the next competition. And in the next 2 years, I think my worst result was maybe third.
Wow.
Okay. Well, I finished competitions. I was number one in the world in the ASCII rankings. Amazing. So it changed my life and it made me into a winner in competitions. I never had a problem outside climbing, but it was just in competitions that I struggled.
Right. And so I know you can't distill this down into three sentences, but what were the key takeaways? What was the light bulb moment when you go, oh God, that's why I'm screwing it up in competitions?
For me, it was my self-image.
Okay.
So it's the way I perceived myself.
Yeah.
So that's what I had to change. I had to change my thought pattern to thinking, I don't like competitions. I compete badly in competitions. I blow it in the final. Things like I always get to the final and blow it in the final. So I have to change the way I perceived myself. Okay. That was the problem that I had. So the way I did that was it's kind of a little bit like brainwashing yourself. So I wrote down on a piece of paper how I wanted to compete and exactly what I was going to do in the next competition. So it was a simple sentence. I wrote that down and I posted that all over the house.
Right.
So every time I opened the fridge door, I'd read it and say, I'm a winner. I love competing. I do my best climbing in competitions. I get nervous, but that gives me power and strength. Something like that. So I wrote that down all over the thing. And I read and read and read this. Mm-hmm. Are you still there?
Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah. So I just read and read this. And you kind of like brainwash yourself into that sort of way of thinking. So that was my personal problem. And that's why I had to change.
Right. Okay. And Just going back slightly, why do you think that there was this kind of blockage when it came to competitions? What was it about the difference between climbing on your own or climbing with mates on the, you know, on the crag to climbing?
Right. Well, the thing is, back in the 80s, it was before climbing competitions. So I started climbing and there were no climbing competitions. So I wasn't brought up in a competition environment. Yeah. If I'd been a golfer, for instance, you have weekly medals in your golf club. So you will always play a competition. Mm-hmm. If you go to the first tee and you're playing with your mate, you're saying, let's pay for a pound.
Yeah.
You're always playing for a competition. Whereas with climbing, it's just you against the rock. If you don't do it, you just go back the next day and try it again.
Right.
So I wasn't in that competition environment. So I climbed up to the age of 26. I'd never done any competing. So the whole environment was very different. So that was my problem. I just wasn't used to doing competitions.
Right.
And also, I didn't particularly like competitions. I quite liked what appealed me to climbing was just being out in the countryside with your mate. You just try something and you fall off and you try it again. But you didn't have that one-on-one battle,
yeah,
like in a snooker match where you're on the table trying to beat your opponent. And climbing's not like that.
I guess a more fundamental question, and I speak to quite a lot of climbers who tell me exactly the same thing, that they don't really like competitions that much. Do you think climbing needs these competitions to... I mean, why does climbing need these competitions when I speak to so many climbers who... Oh, that's a bigger question. But
some climbers like it. Some climbers just love competing.
Yeah.
And they've been brought up on it. And nowadays, you know, competitions have been around for, 25 years, 30 years? I don't know. They've been around a long time. Mm-hmm. And in local climbing walls, they'll have competitions just for the kids. So they're brought up on it. And some people just love competing and they don't like climbing outside.
Yeah.
They just like climbing on artificial stuff. Mm. And climbing is a real broad, range of things that you can do in climbing. You can climb without ropes and risk your life,
yeah,
or you can just go bouldering and do, you know, 2 meter boulder problems, or you can use a rope and be completely safe. You can do long routes, you can do mountaineering.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different things and there's room in there for everybody. So people who just want to compete, then, you know, that's up to them. But for me, climbing was my battle against the rock.
Yeah.
So it was a boxing match, it was a fight, it was a wrestling match between the 10 meters of rock in front of me, and it was me against the rock and who's going to win. And that's what I enjoyed. I enjoyed the battle against the piece of rock that was in front of me.
So once you started succeeding in competitions and you were using that mindset more and more in competitions, how did that affect your climbing when you were back outside and back doing what you...
Well, it affected my climbing that I got completely hooked on competitions and I left the roots of why I enjoyed climbing, which was traveling, doing new routes. My speciality was doing new climbs. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do new grades of climbs and new routes and travel to different areas. So while I was competing, it was very difficult to do that. So I made the decision at the end of, I think it was 1990, I just won a big competition in Moriem, which was a multi-competition. So it's speed climbing. It was the first ever sort of like the World Cup now. So it was speed climbing, bouldering, red pointing and on sighting. And I won that one. That was everything. And I thought, well, I've won everything on that one.
Yeah.
I just want to go back to my roots and do new routes and travel and not be so stressed. And I got really stressed. Even though I did well in the competitions,
I
was really stressed. And yeah. My hair was dropping out and I was going grey very quickly. So I thought, no, I'm going to go back to my room.
But did those lessons that you learn about this kind of positivity, this self-image help you on, help you succeed more back on, you know?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It changed my life because I used that book for everything.
Right.
I used it in business. So I had I used to go meet sponsors and try and get my sponsor money.
Yeah.
And I used what I learned in that book to get my sponsor money.
Right.
So I used to
what was
think,
the book?
Right, I'm going to write down, what's my goal? Yeah. My goal is to get this. How am I going to get it? And what am I going to do for them? And what are the bad things that might happen? What are the trick questions they're going to ask me that might throw me and what are my answers going to be? So if I went into a meeting, I knew any question that I could think of that would be a really difficult question for me to answer, I had a response to it. Right. So one of the things that's very important for competing and or any performance is to be super pessimistic.
Okay.
You don't want to be optimistic. You want to be pessimistic, not just as you're walking into the meeting thinking, oh, this is all going to go wrong. Mm. But two weeks before, a month before you're competing or whatever you want to do, it might be a speech in front of school you have to do, anything that's going to stress you out, think about it a long time in advance and think about all the things that are going to go wrong. And then one by one, tick about what your responsibility, what your response will be mm-hmm. to that negative thing happening. And from that, you can go into the meeting, well, I know if that goes wrong, that goes wrong, that goes wrong. I've got a response to all those things.
Yeah.
So I'm in a really powerful position. So I did it with all my sponsorship meetings and everything. I wrote everything down. I was fully prepared and I've used it, you know, throughout my life.
Blimey. I mean, even kind of adhering to that kind of methodology still takes something else within you to do that, to stick with it, because I mean there are a lot of
intense.
Especially now there are an awful lot of these kind of, you know, you only need to fly go through an airport somewhere and there's, you know, there's shelves of these kind of succeed in business books, but I would guess that a lot of them don't get read past page 32.
No. A lot of them don't. The main thing is, in all business, in all sport, in everything, all the people succeed do things the same way.
Yeah.
They goal set. They have a plan. They write it down. They're super intense. Mm-hmm. And the way I look about it, if I was going to say to somebody, "Why read the book?" If the two people competing, and one guy has read the book and written everything down and written down exactly how he's going to compete mm-hmm. and he's thought about that and worked on it really hard, and the other guy's just turning up to wing it, who are you going to back? Who are you going to put your money on?
Yeah.
You're going to put your money on the guy who's been writing it down, who's been thinking about it and knows exactly what he should be thinking and what he should be doing. That's the guy you're going to back.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And it is intense. It's not the kind of book you read once and put down. You won't get anything out of that. You want to get the book and just read it and read it and read it and just keep going back to the thing. I need to reread it again. I've not read it for a while. But with winning in mind, when I had that first book in the 80s, I took that around with me everywhere.
Yeah. What was that book?
That was With Winning in Mind by Lanny Basham.
Okay.
So things have moved on from there. And some of the things he said in there, I think it's, you know, slightly different. Okay. So that's an older book. So things, psychology has moved on a little bit from then, but still, it's a great book.
So let's go back to your early history in terms of climbing. When, you know, what was your first exposure climbing? When was the time you were first taken out onto the crag? When was the moment you thought, this is what I love?
Well, I went to school in Wales. In Llandudno, and I first went out with we had a climbing club at school, so I went out with the climbing instructor when I was 15. And I can honestly say I was terrified. I walked up to the cliff. I didn't know what to expect. I thought it'd be just like scrambling up the side of some hill. Mm-hmm. And we went up to this vertical white limestone cliff, and I remember thinking, oh my God.
You're right.
Is that what it is? We're going to climb up that? And I think it was quite cold. It was winter. And when you climb in the cold, you get hot aches in your hands. Your hands get really cold, and then the blood goes to them, and you have all this pain in your fingers. So I did this climb. Mm-hmm. I was terrified. I've got these hot aches. I was in pain. And it was a good experience, but I was like, whoa, I'm not too sure about this. So I didn't do it for about another month. Mm-hmm. And then I went again. And when I went again the second time, I enjoyed it. And my best friend at school, he was a climber. And a lot of my friends at school climbed. And they were saying, come climbing, come climbing. I was into rugby at the time and I wasn't bothered. Then I went out with them and I was kind of almost as good as them straight away.
Yeah.
So I think with the ego, you're thinking, oh, I'm quite good at this. So thinking that you're quite good at it, I got more into it. And then when I was, after about a year, I got really, really hooked on it. And the building of the school was made out of limestone and you could climb on the little cracks and edges of the building.
Okay.
So every sort of lunchtime I'd go there with my Doc Martin boots and I'd just go traversing on these holes just for fun. I didn't realize it, but it was It was training and bouldering. And back then, in the I started in 78, so it'd be 79. Nobody was doing that kind of thing.
Right.
And then when I was just before I was 17, I was completely hooked and I wanted to be a rock climber. Yeah. I failed all my exams at school. I wasn't academic at all. I wanted to be a climber. And I said to myself, you know, I want to be a rock climber. So my every lesson, which I had free, mm-hmm. I would jump over the back of the wall and spend that lesson climbing. So right. I said, I'm going to be a climber. I've got a 1 hour English lesson. I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to be a climber. So I'm going to do 1 hour of traversing because that's going to be my education.
Right.
So my climbing progressed very, very quickly. So I started at 15. By the time I was 18, I was probably the best climber in England. And when I was 19, I was definitely the best climber in the world.
Blimey.
So I went straight up, but nobody else was doing that kind of intense training back then.
Yeah. And who, I mean, over such a short period of time, how did the rest of the community kind of respond to it? Were the people who you looked up to, were the people who you thought, these are the people I need to know if I'm going to really progress, or were you kind of off on your own?
Exactly, yes. I mean, I looked for the people. I had, you know, absolute heroes. I remember seeing Ron Fawcett, who was one of my heroes. I remember seeing him at the cliff, and I was just like, it's Ron Fawcett. Mm-hmm. It's Ron Fawcett. I just couldn't believe I was seeing Ron Fawcett. Yeah. And then I remember he'd finished a climb and he was walking on the top of the cliff, and I was doing a climb, and he just walked down and looked at me, and I was like, Ron Fawcett has seen me climbing. Yeah. And I was like, hello, my mate, Ron Fawcett looked at me. Yeah. And I was climbing. So he was I see him a lot now. He lives in Sheffield.
Yeah.
But he was one of my first heroes. But something I have always done, I've always tried to make friends and get in there with better people than me and ask them a lot of information. Yeah. So throughout my career, if I'm with somebody, I want to get every single piece of information out of them as I can. You know, how do you train? What do you do? What do you think? All that stuff.
Yeah.
And just try and get everything from them. And, you know, and that's been really helpful.
And do you think the things that you heard back then were resonate with what's in the book now?
No, right. Because I didn't really know, because there was no sports psychology stuff, so, and there was no training. There was, you know, that was very, very early on.
Right. But were these people naturally visualizing? Like, were they doing it without necessarily considering it? And were
Yes, definitely. They were definitely visualizing stuff, because if you're thinking about something, you're visualizing it.
Yeah.
So if you go to bed and you think, what am I going to do tomorrow? I think I'll go to Llandovno and climb Axel Attack.
Yeah.
You're going to lie there, think I'll do that, and you're lying then you're thinking about the moves. So that's a specific climb. So that's already visualization. You're visualizing something.
Yeah.
And visualization is the link between actually doing something. So visualization is really, really important. It's the direct link. If you can't visualize it, it's very unlikely you're going to do it.
Right. Okay. And that's something that you hear, like I say, you hear from lots of athletes in all different spheres. It's standing on the podium, it's, you know, winning the Super Bowl, you know, is those sort of things are what athletes around the world do.
Yes, but you want to be visualizing your performance. So okay. Visualizing your performance, and you might not always visualize your performance going that great. You know, you might be in a tennis match. If you're a tennis player and you're two sets down, you're fighting for your life, you're a breakdown. That's what you want to visualize. You want to visualize that comeback, smashing it in, getting it in, coming back from that, winning the game.
Yeah.
So you don't always want to visualize just, you know, just smoothly going along and doing your thing. You know, mm-hmm. Visualize staying calm, not losing your temper. Just calm it down. You know, just stay calm. Don't lose your temper. Things like don't rush, all those different things.
Okay.
Putting different words into your heads and stuff like that.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit about how the sport of climbing has changed since, you know, your time in the 80s, that kind of period, and to now. Do you see generally the base level of how climbers prepare for all sorts of climbing have changed over the years?
Oh, hugely. Absolutely hugely. I mean, if you think about early 80s, we didn't have any indoor climbing walls. We didn't have any books on training, we didn't have any books on psychology. Mm-hmm. We didn't have coaches. we didn't even have cars. We used to hitchhike everywhere. We had no money, no professional climbers.
Sure. Do you think this kind of, I mean, is it a slow professionalization of, or a very quick professionalization of the sport that has led to this mind shift?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think the big difference is climbing walls. I mean, for me, to think that, say on, you have the, in Scandinavia, for instance, in Sweden, you have three, in Stockholm, you might have 3 million-pound climbing walls, and 95% of the people there don't climb outside.
Yeah.
Or you have a lot of the big climbing walls in London, people don't climb outside. So for me, going back to where I started in the late 70s, early 80s, it's just unfathomable to think that people would climb on plastic and never go outside.
It's just
incredible, you know. Or even the best climbers, some of the best climbers in the world, are not bothered about climbing outside.
Yeah.
They want to compete and they want to train and get strong. So the sport has really changed, and I think it will really change with the Olympics. And people will see speed climbing and they'll go, "Oh wow, speed climbing looks great," and it does look really good on television. It's a great spectator sport. But from me, where I come from, you'd never want to be a speed climber. It's not real climbing. You'd be like, that's a joke.
Right.
But you know, it will change, and somebody will win the speed climbing thing, and his manager and his sponsors are going to say, look, we've got the best climber in the world. He's got a gold medal and stuff like that. So it'll change.
Do you lament that a little bit, or are you...
You just got to let it go, haven't you? I mean, it's... To me, they're not the best. You've got it. For me personally, you have to do it outside. You have to do it on rock. I mean, that's where I come from, because, you know, it's a plastic thing. It's just going to get taken down and just, you know, chopped in a skip somewhere. Whereas the climbs that I did 30 years ago, you can go there and climb them, and you can say, this was the top grade of climbing. This was the hardest route in 1982, and it's still there.
Yeah.
This was the hardest route in 83. This is what Joe Brown did on Stanage when he did the Dangler in the 50s. So it's great to be able to go out and still climb that history.
Sure. And when you had the book in mind, when you were writing the book, who were you writing it for? Were you writing it for you in 1982?
I was writing it to document it and just to give climbers just something really, really good to grab hold of. So it wasn't for the best climbers. It was for everybody, and it was for everybody who wants to get the most out of themselves, to improve themselves and their self-worth and stuff like that. So I wrote it for everybody, really, but it was mainly, I felt like I was in a great position to document everything. And there's not many people that the top climbers would speak to. So all the top climbers, I'd phone up and say, "Chris Sharma, Chris, I'm doing this book. Can you help out?" And they said yes, because, you know, I was one of their, you know, people they looked up to when they were kids. So they all helped out. Whereas if it had just been a normal journalist, they wouldn't have done quite as much.
No, that's right. What were the, having spoken to all these incredible climbers, what are the common threads that you saw amongst everything that they said? I mean,
well, I think one of the main things, the most successful ones.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody like Killian Fischhuber, an Austrian guy who'd won so many competitions. He was so good.
Yeah.
He won everything. He was one of the ones who said, well, when I start to think about competitions, I do my visualization a couple of weeks in advance, and I think about all the things that can go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking of the one climber you think is going to be optimistic and not think about those things. It's him.
Yeah.
Or the same with Adam Ondra. I mean, he was mentally so strong, the way he did his warm-ups and how he prepared for things. And he was one who just worked the whole time in his confidence. I think not so much doing it, thinking that he was doing it, but he was doing it. So he was doing the things in the book, which I say do, without realizing that he was doing them. So if he had a bad warm-up, he would say, okay, I've had a bad warm-up, but I'm not going to think about that. I'm going to think about the warm-up that I had a week ago when I felt really good warming up. And today I didn't warm up good, but it was a little bit hotter. My skin wasn't quite as good. I didn't feel quite as good for those reasons, but I felt really good and the temperature was better as a week ago. So that's going to be my visualization of my warm-up. And I'm going to think about that warm-up. And I'm not going to lose it in a week, so I'm probably still really strong. I'm going to hang there with that one and then go to my climb.
Right.
Instead of warming up and having a bad warm up, thinking, oh God, it's all going to go wrong today. I felt terrible warming up, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So he's the best climber in the world. And you're thinking, not only that, he's got an incredible mindset, So if you're competing against him, man, it's going to be hard.
Right. Okay. Was there anybody who surprised you in terms of how they approach it? Were there people like we've been interviewing people on this podcast now for a couple of years, and especially with ultra athletes, there seems to be very different ways to approach it. Some are very rigorous in their training and document everything and have an app for this and an app for that. And some people are just much less fastidious when it comes to that training. And to a certain extent, both, you know, equally successful. Was there any of the climbers who you spoke to who would go, you know, who really took you by surprise in what they said?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, none of them really surprised me, but I think everybody approaches things different. So everybody's got different strengths. So some people may not be nervous standing in front of a crowd. And some people are nervous standing in front of a crowd. And the person standing in front of the crowd who gets really nervous might be an absolute hell man without a rope or some hideous base jumper.
Right.
You know, you might get nervous about one thing, but not nervous about another thing. So One of the things in the book, you have to find out how you respond to different things.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, some of the climbers were more relaxed than others, but it didn't really surprise me that much. They were they did all the same sort of things when it comes to visualization and drive. One of the things is that they all have drive. So
right.
Top people, they all have an inner drive.
Yeah.
So that's the most important thing. And that's one that's really quite hard to, that comes from all your upbringing.
Yeah, that's not something that you
youth
can...
And how you're brought up, it's really hard something to train.
Right.
You know, why would somebody want to just, you know, go hitch like I did when I was a kid, hitchhiking out every weekend, you know, in the rain, when everybody else was just like, oh no, it's not going to be nice weather, so let's go to the CAF. And I'd be going out there by myself and training again and again and not going out to nightclubs and doing all those things. No sacrifice at all. That's what I wanted to do, and it was the best times of my life. But why do you get that drive?
Yeah.
So the thing all those people have in common is they have a drive and they're very, very, very driven.
Right. I see. Okay. And one of the sections in the book is kind of these inspirational stories about, you know, from climbers. Tell us a little bit more about why you felt the need to include that.
Right. Well, my point was that you'd read through all the book, and then you might be in Spain or something like that. You're down there for a week. You're trying a project. You're trying to do the project and you're not doing great on the project. You've read the book. You know how you should be thinking. And then I wanted to inspire people. So I wanted them to have, I think there's 16 short stories in the back of the top climbers. And I said, what was your best day climbing where you pulled it out of the bag, where everything was going wrong, but you still did the climb, or you did it on the last day of a trip or something like that. So my idea was that people could go there, climb, read the book. And if they're struggling on a route, they could read those short stories and they might have a favorite one and they could go there and read that. And that would give them some inspiration and some motivation just to think, well, look, they did that then. Right, I'm here now. And it would just give them that little trigger point to just get a little bit more inspired and fired up.
Right.
So it's got that in there as well. And they're just, you know, they're good stories.
Yeah. Were there stories that you used to go back to that you'd heard that used to
inspire
you?
Absolutely.
Well, can you think of any off the top of your head?
Yeah, some articles and stuff. I read them. I knew every single word in them. There was some article about Milky Way, which Ron Fawcett wrote in Crags. And I went on holiday and I was 16 with my parents to Wales, sitting on the beach. I was miles away from climbing. And I just read that article again and again. And I knew every single word in it. Well, I'll read it again. There was a book called Master of Rock on Bouldering. I knew it word for word.
Right.
And I just read it again and again and again because, you know, what else was I to do? I couldn't climb. So I read them and then they got me fired up. So hopefully there'll be little pieces in the book that people get excited about. Not the whole thing. There might be something go, that's what I need. That's me. That's my problem. That's what I need to work on. I'm going to work on that and read that. Or they've got different sections from different climbers who are doing different things. And they might say, that's that applies to me. That's the one I like. And I'm just going to read that repeatedly and get motivated on it.
Yeah. So certain things are going to resonate with certain people. And I guess for all, exactly, yeah, for kind of all levels, would you say?
Yes, or is it all levels? It's like, you know, it's from beginner to experienced climber. It's like I was saying to somebody, somebody was saying, how would this help the beginner climber? Well, if you want to learn how to play golf, mm-hmm. you're going to get a book on Tiger Woods and find out how he plays golf. Yeah. You want to, you know, obviously you're a complete beginner, mm-hmm. but you're going to want a book. You want a book by the greatest golfer or the greatest climber. Think, what does he do? How does he hold the golf club? How does he swing it? Mm-hmm. So it's for, you know, the book's for complete beginners. So even though it's got the best climbers in there, it doesn't mean it's just for the best climbers. It's just an example of what they're doing.
Sure. One of the interesting things about the book, apart from it, is, I mean, it's beautifully designed. It's very vibrant. Yeah, it looks amazing. But there's also pages where you've left blank for the readers to, and it kind of looks a bit like a notebook.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about how that idea came about.
I think, like I said earlier, to get the most out of the book, you don't want to. You're not going to do, if you read it once and put it down, it's not going to do very much.
Sure.
You really need to carry the book around. Read it, reread it again. I mean, maybe if you're super clever, you could read it once and have a photographic memory, but yeah. mostly you're going to have to read it again and again. Mm-hmm. And then in there, I put little exercises so you can write down what are your goals, how are you going to achieve your goals, what your grade is now, what grade you want to climb. So on different parts of the book, I've left pages in there so you can actually write in the book. And there's a little pencil holder thing where you can put your pencil in there. And a little piece of string so you can find where you are in the book. So it wants to be like a diary and a journal type thing.
Yeah.
So that's how I wanted the book. I wanted it to be a messy book that you just chuck in your rucksack, you carry it around with you and you scribble it and write in it and you go, had a great day today, reinforce that, you know, bank that success and things like that. Things like that are very important, you know, to reinforce when you're successful, really reinforce that and try and just, you know, forget the negatives.
Sure. Did you ever have a journal or some kind of method for?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So I had a journal. I took that with me everywhere. That was straight after reading with Winning in Mind.
Gotcha.
I got a diary and I diarized everything I did. So, but how you write your diary is very important. So I wrote everything in that diary was good.
Okay.
So if I didn't have a good day, I'd write the best things that happened about that day.
Right, okay.
So when I went to a competition, I could take that diary with me. I could flick that diary open anywhere. I'd open it up and go, oh yeah, I remember that day. I went to Raven's Tour. I warmed up, felt good. I did this, this, and this. Then it turned really hot, went in the sun. It was a greasy day, but I still climbed great in the sun and I still had a great day climbing. So I could go to that book and it would reinforce things. And at the bottom of that page, in every single day, I wrote down what my goal was for that year. So I would put, say I've got the Leeds competition coming up in 2 months' time. I put, I am the winner of Leeds 1989. I climbed smooth and great and won the final, for instance. So I would write that down on every single page. So it's just reinforcing it all the time. So every time I read my goal at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit intense and it's kind of a, you know, and a real kind of an American thing and you kind of go, but it works, you know?
Well, yeah, this is it. And you kind of hear more and more about bringing these kind of elements, this idea of journaling into kind of daily life and daily practice. People who have never climbed in their lives or, you know, not outdoorsy, but these are little little ways that people can help boost through.
Yes. Yeah. And indeed, when we interviewed Margot Hayes, who's probably the best female climber in the world today, we interviewed her and she kept it. It was almost like she'd read the book before she'd done the interview and she'd never even heard of the book. But she said, oh, yeah, I write a journal, I visualize things, I do this. It was just like, oh, my mate interviewed and he said, you've got to listen to this interview. It's incredible because it is just exactly. She just was doing exactly what you were doing, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's great to see that that's how, you know, she's in her early 20s and, you know, did the first 9A for a woman and she's probably the best female climber in the world. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. So now the book's out the way. What's keeping you occupied?
Well, I'm just, unfortunately, I broke my neck earlier this year surfing. So
I didn't know that.
Sports. Unfortunately, I'm one of these people who likes getting scared.
Okay.
And so one of my big passions was surfing. Yeah. I was in Lanzarote earlier this year and I went down in a wave and got headbutted a sandbar.
Oh my God.
Snapped my neck. So this year's been a bit of a write-off really in hospital and getting back and learning to walk again. But now I'm doing great. So a lot of my time is spent stretching and rehabbing, but that's getting better. And one of the things I've started doing from that is I've just started climbing again. I've not climbed for probably 15 years. Right. I've climbed a little bit, but I've just started doing some easy climbing just to get some strength back in my shoulders and get my posture better and stuff like that.
Right.
So that's what I'm on with at the moment. Kicking back in. I'm pretty much retired now, so I don't need to work. So taking the dogs out and stuff like that.
Right. Are you, you've got a goal ahead of you to hit as well then?
My goal is to stay away from injury.
Yeah, right. Okay. So no more surfing goal. For a while
across
then.
The road now, I look left and right about 10 times. Right. I've got a little Cub Scout to help me across the road. I just don't want to go back to hospital. So I just want to say stay safe and healthy and keep my fitness and stuff like that and just enjoy what I'm doing.
Brilliant. And then a bit of promo for the book.
Yes. Yeah. Cool. It's nice to, you know, doing the book's a fun thing. It's not a business for me. It's just nice to put something, you know, back into climbing as a money thing. It doesn't make any money, but it's quite good to document it. And people come up, and I've had a bunch of people come up saying they've read the book and it's helped them out. And I had one girl who got on the American team from reading the book. Wow. So it's really nice when people come up and say that's really changed my life and it's really helped. So it's quite rewarding in that aspect.
Sure. Great. Jerry Moffat, thank you so much for joining us. Really enlightening chat. So really, yeah, just appreciate your time and your insight and, your stories.
Yeah. Thanks very much for having me.
Cheers. Thanks. And there we have it. Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for your time and your generosity with all that knowledge earned over so long. The book Mastermind's available now, so you can pick it up wherever you normally get your books from. And thanks, as ever, for listening. If you like what you've heard, please go to wherever you get your podcast from, leave a review. And next month, we've got a really, really great kind of curveball interviewee coming up. Really excited. Listen in.